1810, Cole versus Skemp. Mr. Colby, you are first to argue. Before you begin, I do want to welcome on behalf of the court the Department of Justice legal interns. If they would stand, please. Thank you for coming. You may be seated. Mr. Colby.
Justice Abramson, members of the court. What brings us here today is the tragic death of a young woman from Lacrosse, 19 years of age, who died of an arteriovenous malformation that ruptured, causing hemorrhage within her brain and her death. Her death occurred on May 23rd of 1995. The rupture occurred one day prior, on May 22nd of 1995. This young lady had had a history of headaches, history that dated back to the early 90s and proceeded forward up to and including the time of her death. This young woman had sought medical care and treatment at the Skemp Clinic in Lacrosse, and she had only sought her medical care and treatment from physicians at the Skemp Clinic in Lacrosse. Three dates that are of critical importance in this case are November 20th of 1994, the date on which Ms. Ball saw Dr. Fred Skemp for complaints of headache. She was referred by Dr. Skemp, who was concerned about gynecological problems as a source of the headache, to a gynecologist, of course, and she was seen by Dr. Virginia Updegraff on December 20th of 1994. She was again referred out, and her third and final visit at the clinic was on March 17th of 1995, where she saw Dr. Theodore Hamel. Between March 17th of 1995 and the time of Jenny's death, her headaches continued. On May 22nd of 1995, she had what was described as the worst headache she had ever experienced. She was rushed to a chiropractor's office nearby her home, whom she trusted, and was subsequently transported to St. Francis Medical Center and ultimately to the Gunderson Lutheran Medical Center in Lacrosse, where she expired.
Just a question, counsel. Since you mentioned the chiropractor, she had received at least advice from the chiropractor that she should get a primary physician. I also believe in the record it showed that she had received at least on 11-20-94 from Dr. Skemp that he encouraged and emphasized the importance of becoming established with a primary care physician. So both of them incurred due to these headaches. Is that correct, sir?
Justice Wilcox, I believe that the record shows that the chiropractor was suggesting a referral to a neurologist or to someone who specialized in those types of problems as opposed to a primary physician. And as the court is well aware, the problem was under the insurance policy available to Jenny's mother, they couldn't simply make a referral directly to a neurologist. In any event, this action was commenced on March 16th of 1998. A lawsuit was filed on behalf of Jenny's parents and on behalf of the estate of Jennifer Jo Paul. Two causes of action are alleged. One is a standard wrongful death cause of action under 89354 on behalf of her parents, and the survival claim by the estate of Jenny. And that, of course, is the issue why we're here today, is 89355. The applicability of the timing of the commencement of this lawsuit. As the court is aware, under 89355, this medical malpractice action can be brought within 3 years of the date of the injury or 1 year from the date that the injury was discovered, with certain parameters being included in the statute up to including 5 years.
Mr. Colby, when summary judgment was granted here, was it granted in regard to both claims, the wrongful death claim and the survivor claim?
That's an interesting issue, Justice Brooks. The only issue that was before the court, and the only issue that I understood was grant, that we were focused on, was the issue of the applicability of 89355. And I think that is one of the concerns that generated the Waddle amicus brief, because here we have a situation where the Court of Appeals has effectively discharged and dismissed the wrongful death claim, which should not have been extinguished.
So, in other words, it's your understanding that what the trial court did was grant a motion in regard to the survivor action, but not in regard to the wrongful death action?
Well, the trial court dismissed the entire action.
Okay.
And it's clear that the pleadings included claims for both wrongful death and the survivor claims. I think it's important that the court understand in this case that this case is not a latent injury case. I think that the court should also understand that this is not a discovery rule case. Jenny had headaches that preceded her visit to Dr. Skemp, and she continued to have headaches after the treatment that she received from Dr. Skemp, Dr. Updegraff, and Dr. Hable.
Counsel, I'm a little slow, I guess, picking up on Justice Crooks's point, but it's also the point I note of Judge Dykeman's dissent, besides the amicus of Waddle. What do we do with that point? That is, Judge Dykeman in his dissent says that I conclude that the injury for which the estate sued the clinic is Paul's death and that the suit was brought within 3 years of, 3 years of the death. And it's a wrongful death action. So we have that in Judge Dykeman's dissent. We have the amicus brief. What, if anything, are you asking that we as a court do with wrongful death, if anything, here?
Well, I think what we're asking the court to do, obviously, is to reverse the decision of the Court of Appeals and give us some sense of direction as to where we're going with 89355. The defense interpretation, the respondent's interpretation, is that the date of injury is the date of the last negligent act in a misdiagnosis case. And they cite to the court a series of cases that they believe supports that proposition. However, what's troubling is the Court of Appeals in the Corbin case discusses what the Court of Appeals believed to be the physical injurious change as being the triggering event for date of injury.
That was under a different statute, though, wasn't it?
Kojic was this statute.
What year is Kojic? Was that 1980? I might be wrong.
Kojic is a 97 case. Yeah. And, of course, the problem that we have is the date of injury has always been the issue, and at least from the time that I was in law school forward, a negligence claim has always been comprised of two factors, a negligent act and an injury. And in the Paul case, we have the circumstances where we have a negligent act, a misdiagnosis. And 89355 includes an omission to act. So a misdiagnosis is clearly included. But what we have then is a situation where, as a result of the misdiagnosis, Jenny continues on without treatment until May 22nd. Her brain explodes, and she dies. And this brings us then to the comments by Judge Dykeman. And that is, the Court of Appeals indicated, and it's kind of a convoluted point that the Court of Appeals makes. They conclude medically that Jenny was, quote, continuously disabled as a result of the misdiagnosis of the cause of her headaches, and accordingly, her last date of injury was the last date on which the failure to diagnose occurred. And then the Court of Appeals footnoted their decision by saying, contrary to the assertion of the dissent by Judge Dykeman, we do not conclude that Jenny's injury was her headaches. As we have explained, her injury was the misdiagnosis of the cause of her headaches. And as this court has pointed out repeatedly, from Robbins forward, until you have a compensable act, until we have some injury to Jenny, that claim does not accrue. And this court is vested with the responsibility and authority to determine when a claim accrues.
Well, it was the counsel. It was the lack of discovery of his brain difficulty. Isn't that the misdiagnosis? That's what they're talking about, that this has been going on for a period of time. And Wisconsin is, at least as I understand it, has traditionally been a misdiagnosis state as far as looking at what starts the time. So that's what we're talking about, a misdiagnosis.
Well, we have a misdiagnosis,
yes.
But the misdiagnosis does not trigger the running of the statute of limitations until such time as the misdiagnosis results in an injury.
Do all these statutes, and I apologize for having had to leave for a few minutes, and if my question is repetitive of someone else's, just say that and I'll listen to the tape. I'll listen to it anyway. Has the statute always been injury for medical malpractice? Because a lot of these statutes are date of accrual.
The prior statute, the statute that was involved in Koshnik, that we sort of dealt with, that didn't involve the injury language that we have.
Did not. Right. What was the language there? Do you remember? Oh, first of all, you have to then stand in front of a microphone so you're taped, sir.
I don't have the exact language of 893-205, but the statute was somewhat different than the present statute.
Mm-hmm. It did say damages for injuries. Thank you.
And so what we're dealing with in this case is a situation where we have a young lady who has complaints of headache preceding her visits with the clinic, complaints of headache following her visits with the respective physicians in the clinic, and ultimately an injury that arises on May 22nd of 1995. And I believe it's important because in the Court of Appeals, Alford's decision, there was some discussion of a similar situation. As the Court will recall, this was an elbow dislocation case, a latent injury case, if you will. And that discussion basically centered around the injury becoming symptomatic at a later point in time. And in the Alford's decision, the Court of Appeals indicated if this medical condition will inevitably result in some disability, the plaintiff has sustained an injury as of the date of the failure to diagnose.
Counsel?
Yes.
That language, I guess I view this area, the case law is a bit confusing. For instance, you take that very language that you cited from Elfers, which states that the plaintiff has sustained an injury as of the date the failure to diagnose occurred. Okay? So Elfers gives us that test. That's a 1997 District 3 Court of Appeals. The same year, District 1 Court of Appeals gives us a different date. And I look at the Fogent case, and In Fojt, we conclude that the date of injury, unlike Elfers, and I'm putting my words in here, unlike Elfers, which I just read, who said is the date of the misdiagnosis. In Folger, same year, different district court of appeals, said we conclude that the date of injury was the day Helen became pregnant, as opposed to the date of any kind of tubal ligation or any kind of procedure. So that seems like we have conflicting court of appeals opinions within the last couple of years. Am I right or am I wrong?
No, you're correct, Justice Bradley, and I think this court of appeals decision goes even one step further, which prompts our request to this court, where we have the Court of Appeals coming in and saying, what we have here is a misdiagnosis, no attempt to ascertain the date of the injury, but then the Court of Appeals says that the injury was the misdiagnosis of the cause of the headaches. And I think what Judge Dykeman was trying to point out was the headaches existed before the alleged malpractice, and the headaches continued after the alleged malpractice. And of course, we have to have a negligent act and an injury caused by that act. And Elfers and all of the cases have stood for that proposition. And the headaches were not caused by malpractice. What was caused by malpractice was the blowout, the hemorrhage in the brain that occurred on May 22nd. There was only one expert affidavit filed in this case at the summary judgment stage. It was filed by a physician who said that no injury occurred on November 20th of 1994, no injury occurred on December 20th of 1994, and no injury occurred on March 17th of 1995. And what that same expert said, which is Dr. King, and his affidavit is part of the record, is that the condition that Jenny had could be treated medically with medication. It could be treated surgically at any point in time up to the day it blows on May 22nd of 1995. And up to and including that point in time, if someone had properly diagnosed her condition, she could have been saved. And as Dr. King indicates in his affidavit, which is part of the record, this is a kind of condition that can continue on for a substantial period of time. It's not like the brain tumor, the lesion type of circumstance. It's not the blood transfusion from the Olson case. It's not the dislocated elbow that goes misdiagnosed. This is a condition that existed for a substantial period of time, and had the physicians acknowledged this injury, it could have been treated. So Jenny didn't get worse.
Counsel acknowledged it or discovered it. That's the point. What acknowledged it, we're talking here about a person who in 1992 had a CAT scan, and that's in the record. So a CAT scan of the brain, and it came back normal. Now, so they missed it, so to speak, assuming it was there in 1992. We assume all along that these headaches were not of a migraine condition that was determined. I think Dr. Skim talked about the history and that her mother had migraines, but there had been a headache condition. So I'm just saying that we're talking about a discovery, aren't we, rather than acknowledgement?
Well, just look, I have a problem with discovery because we have never maintained that this is a discovery rule case. This is a date of injury case.
Right.
And as the court's well aware, not only did the CAT scan in 92 indicate the condition wasn't there, but every time Jenny went to a doctor, they said, you've got sinus problems, you've got tension headaches, you've got, it's your period, you've got gynecological problems, but nobody took the time to do what Dr. Metelsky, the chiropractor, said should be done. A neurologist should follow up with this child. No one did that.
Except, as I said, that was in 94 when they talked about a primary physician to look into this.
And I think if I can interrupt for a minute, how do you get around the Koshnick case? It's my understanding that in that case, this court said that the date of injury caused by a failure to diagnose a condition is the last date on which a consultation took place, which did not lead to a correct diagnosis for the problem presented by the patient. Now, that seems to run totally counter to what you've been arguing.
Except for two different... We're talking apples and oranges, Justice Brooks. And
tell me why.
Why is, number one, it was a different statute at the time. A totally different statute. Secondly, the context of the discussion in Koshnick came up when the plaintiff in Koshnick wanted to use the physician's letter to support a settlement in an automobile case. And she wanted to extend the statute of limitations from 3 years to 6 years, basically on a contract theory. And what happened ultimately was the alleged malpractice was the doctor didn't transcribe his notes accurately, and as a result of that, the plaintiff settled her personal injury automobile case for less money than she thought she was entitled to. Ultimately, what we're dealing with is the court comes in and says, this is not a contract case. This case stems from a personal injury, and as such, we have to deal with it as a personal injury, a medical malpractice case, and 3 years is the applicable applicable statute.
Well, let's assume for a minute that that is the law in Wisconsin, that the date of injury is the date of the last consultation. You've argued, as I understand it, in the alternative, that if that is the law, then the visit on March 17th is significant. And yet, it's my understanding that you then ran into the dead man statute and hearsay questions. Is that correct?
That's correct, Justice Christ.
Do you think that the Court of Appeals was wrong in the rulings they upheld in regard to the dead man statute and hearsay?
On the hearsay issue, I may spot them, the hearsay issue, but on the dead man statute, I believe they're wrong in terms of the applicability of the dead man statute.
Counsel, I have one more question on the filing, and that is that with the date of death being May 23rd, 1995, and in the record we saw at least some oblique reference to retaining counsel. Was there some reason, or is this not in the record of their failure to file within that 1 year period? You know, in other words, she died in 95. Is there some reason they did not file? They had retained counsel in 96.
I don't think there's anything in the record.
Okay.
Justice Wilcox, it indicates that counsel was retained within the 1 year period of time.
No.
Well, that was in, I'm sorry, I think that is in the record, that counsel was retained in 96. What I'm asking is there some reason of the failure of counsel, or let's put it this way, of the Pauls to file an action within that time period?
I don't think there's anything in the record that reflects a basis for that.
Counsel, now that you have probably about a minute left, I think this case is a statutory interpretation case, so let's get to the statute. unless you disagree, do you think this is not a statutory interpretation case? What do you think?
I think it is a statutory interpretation case.
What statute?
But 893.55.
Okay.
So, now the question, let's take a look at the statute.
893.55.1.
Essentially says, an action to recover damages for injury arising from, and here we're talking about an omission, apparently, aren't we? A misdiagnosis?
Okay. That's true.
So an action to recover damages for injury arising from omission.
Well, line 3 says, from any omission.
From any omission by a person who is a health care provider. So for that, you have 3 years from the date of injury under sub A, right?
Correct.
And so the question is, what does date of injury mean? Is that what we're here about?
That's true.
And look at sub B. Now, that seems to use different words and doesn't refer to the date of injury, but refers to the date of the act or omission with regard to discovery. What import, if any, is there in the use of those different words? In other words, date of injury meaning one thing and date of act or omission that the legislature used in sub B meaning something else.
As long as you'll allow me to respectfully disagree. Sub B says 1 year from the date the injury was discovered, and ultimately act or omission is the absolute 5-year cap when, if you were to use a continuing course of negligent treatment such as has been alleged in this case, under no circumstances can a claim be made outside of 5 years from the act or omission. But date of injury is, Justice Bradley, the important language.
Is date of injury something different than the act or omission?
Yes, clearly. And I think this court has enunciated it, and the Court of Appeals has enunciated it. The negligent act doesn't always equate to date of injury. There are and can be cases, and this is one, where the negligent act occurs at one point in time and the injury occurs substantially later, which is a circumstance that this court addressed in the SOFA case, which, while it was an asbestosis case, the same principles apply there as they apply here.
Thank you, counsel.
Thank you.
You will have 5 minutes in rebuttal. Ms. Newcomb, representing Frederick C. Kemp, Jr. et al.
May it please the court, my name is Virginia Newcomb, and I represent the defendants' respondents in this case. Also present in the court is Dr. Frederick Skemp, Jr., who is a defendant in this case. This case arose out of a tragic incident. There's no question about it. The court is faced with trying to decide whether or not there are conflicts between what the legislature intended in Section 89355 as enacted and how it plays into the facts of this case. The amicus, and I think the amicus brief took me a little bit by surprise, because never before had counsel for plaintiffs argued that Section 89354 should apply to this case at all. This was the first time that that argument was used. I have not had an opportunity to respond to the amicus brief, and I would like to do that just briefly. Using the Supreme Court's decision in 1990 in Reinick versus Johnson, this court found that grafting a wrongful death statute onto 89355, the statute that was crafted for medical malpractice, which resulted in personal injury, was contrary to the express legislative intention to treat medical malpractice claims involving injury or death in exactly the same manner. And this court cited 655.005 and 655.007. This was the case where the defense argued that the statutory limit for wrongful death be applied in a medical malpractice case that was $50,000 at that time, rather than the $1 million cap which the legislature had put on medical malpractice case, the medical malpractice cases. This court rejected that notion and said a medical malpractice case is the same regardless of whether the ultimate damage is injury or death. The amicus has also used the or tried to use the Miller case, Miller versus Luther, which is a Court of Appeals 1992 case, to support their position, which again I believe is factually in error. In this case, it's a negligent diagnosis of skin cancer. However, the medical malpractice portion of the case was dismissed before the court considered the wrongful death aspect of this case. The Court of Appeals does not extend the statute of limitations beyond what's provided in 893.55 in this case. Throughout the exploration that we've had so far this morning, I think Justice Wilcox questions in regard to what happened before Jennifer Paul reached Dr. Skemp's office is quite important. Before Jennifer Paul reached Dr. Skemp's office, she knew and her mother knew that her headache problem may not be something that was simple, something that was just a natural, easily solvable problem. Dr. Metelsky, on four separate occasions, advised Jennifer Paul and her mother that she should seek treatment by a specialist, a neurologist, specifically that she get a brain scan, that she get an MRI, to try to get at the cause of her problems because she had been treated repeatedly by Dr. Metelsky without any relief. So when Jennifer Paul reaches Dr. Skemp's office on November 20, 1994, she's not going there in a vacuum. She knows the information that she's been provided so far by Dr. Metelsky. She knows when she leaves Dr. Skemp's office, November 20, 1994, that he has not referred her to a neurologist, as Dr. Metelsky has suggested. And she also knows that she's not been referred to for a CT scan or an MRI.
Counsel?
Yes.
I need some help with this particular thing, so I'm going to ask you. I think that the issue today is the issue of what is meant by the date of injury set forth in 893.55. Do you agree with that?
I agree that that is probably the primary initial focus.
Okay.
That we have
I know there. I'm sorry. There are other issues certainly, but I mean, I guess the big one is what I'm focused on now. And so our job is to try to discern the intent of what was meant by 893.55 when the legislature in sub 1A said date of injury. And it's your position that the legislature meant this to be the date of the misdiagnosis.
That is correct.
Okay, now this is where I need help. And looking at sub B, the legislature of 893.55 1B, the legislature uses date of injury to be something other than the date of the misdiagnosis, but uses the phrase the date of act or omission, which I take to be
omitting the diagnosis date of misdiagnosis. So I don't understand how you can say date of injury is the same thing in sub A as would be a date of omission, when in sub B the legislature uses those terms differently. So help me with that, because I can't reconcile that.
Okay. Let's just read through the statute and substitute to see if it makes any sense. Substitute the misdiagnosis. Sub 1 says that there's an action to recover damages for injury arising from any treatment or operation performed by or from any omission commenced within the later of 3 years from the date of the misdiagnosis, or 1 year from the date the misdiagnosis was discovered, or in the exercise of reasonable diligence should have been discovered.
You're losing me.
I have tried to insert.
But you didn't.
I'm sorry?
You didn't. You're inserting omission for injury. Well, misdiagnosis for injury, right?
Yes.
Okay, so let's start again at the beginning in 1. Except as provided by 2 and 3, an action to recover damages for a misdiagnosis, arising from a misdiagnosis. Isn't that what you're saying?
Right.
By a person who is a health care provider, regardless of the theory in which the action should be commenced and filing, 3 years from the date of the misdiagnosis.
Right.
Or 1 year from the date the misdiagnosis was discovered, or in the exercise of reasonable diligence should have been discovered, except that an action shall be commenced under this paragraph more than 3 years from the date of the misdiagnosis.
Yes.
So you go, in effect, when you do that, omitted any separate definition of injury. Let's take this example. Suppose we have the same thing and that the plaintiff here was more fortunate and there was no rupture. Can she ever sue for damages?
Yes.
Why?
Because her headaches continued, and there's evidence in this record that after she left Dr. Skemp's office, she was unsatisfied. She didn't find out the reason for her headaches. When she left Dr. Updegraff's office, the same thing occurred. Her headaches, according to Mrs. Paul, in this record, increased in frequency. She missed work. They increased in intensity. And had she had expert testimony to say, this problem has not been reconciled, and Dr. Skemp, you're negligent for not having gotten to the bottom of this, she has a cause of action.
So if she had, there was a misdiagnosis of a serious heart condition or a misdiagnosis about a cancerous condition, takes 10 years and then it is spread or is now no longer treatable, the cause of action is finished?
According to this statute and my interpretation of 893.55, yes, it cannot be longer than 5 years from the date of the act or the omission under any circumstances. That is true.
I don't understand how this plays out, though, with the headache thing. Let's say I go to a doctor with headaches, and there is a misdiagnosis, and the doctor gives me some medication for sinus. Am I supposed to then, and then after that, I continue to have headaches. Am I supposed to go to a malpractice attorney and say, hey, I'm still having headaches, so there must have been a misdiagnosis?
If you have the information from somebody that you have a serious condition which requires a brain scan, which requires follow-up treatment with a neurologist, and you go to a family practice doctor or a walk-in clinic and you don't get to the bottom of the problem, yes. I think this court has interpreted on many occasions that the plaintiff has to use reasonable diligence in the discovery of the injury. And that is a very important aspect of this case. I have argued consistently in my briefing that the last possible date of discovery of this injury or the misdiagnosis was the date of her death on May 23, 1995. For that reason, could she have discovered this earlier? Yes. Had she gone and followed the advice and acted upon the information that she already had, she could have done that. The statute of limitations ran on this case on December 20, 1997 for any causes of action which could be brought. And that's not...
Let me interrupt. Why can't March 17th be used as the last date of consultation?
Because March 17, 1995, the visit with Dr. Hebel had, according to the note, there were no complaints of headache pain. This was a visit for a sore throat. And
well, that's what the doctor says he remembers.
No, that's what's in the record. That's in the clinic.
The record says sore throat. The doctor says he doesn't remember any discussion about headaches. But then you've got the affidavit of the boyfriend, and you've got the testimony of the mother. And aren't we being hyper-technical in keeping out that testimony when we use not only the dead man statute, but also the hearsay statutes, and don't use, for instance, the general exception? Why shouldn't we do that? Why shouldn't we allow that to be considered?
Justice Crooks, I believe that had the statements that are being offered been offered in some contemporaneous form or some admissible form where there was some indicia of reliability to create a question of fact, we would have a different situation here, but we do not. We have conflicting deposition and affidavit testimony, similar to what this court has recently addressed in the Yonke case, where the sham affidavit rule was brought into effect. We have Mrs. Paul, who has testified that she could not recall a time when Jennifer went in after her visit with Dr. Updegrath and complained to any doctor of any headache. The only thing we have is a veiled attempt on the part of the plaintiffs to put in a statement of Kevin Mason about not something he saw, not something he heard Jennifer Paul say to a doctor, but rather a conversation which has never been recorded until after my motion for summary judgment has been brought. And I believe that that is inadmissible and it is improper. You mentioned, Justice Crooks, as to whether or not this ought to, the statement of Kevin Mason ought to come in under 908.045 sub 6. Kevin Mason, as a live-in boyfriend of Jennifer Paul's throughout all this relevant time, has, I'm sure, some guilt in not pursuing Ms. Paul's headaches, which he also knows she continues with frequency and in frequent duration. On the day that she died, rather than taking her to a medical provider, he takes her to a chiropractor, and she essentially collapses and has her final event in the chiropractor's office.
Counsel.
Yes.
Counsel, this is the problem I have with your case. Usually, at least many times, the negligent act and the injury are simultaneous. I get hit by a car out on the road. That's caused by a negligent driver, and it breaks my leg. That's simultaneous. But here we're dealing with misdiagnosis that can remain undiscovered for quite some time. Let me take an example of prostate cancer. Let's assume I go in to see my friendly family doctor, and the doctor fails to diagnose that I have prostate cancer. All right? Even though I do. Now, as I understand that problem, that can sit relatively undiscovered for a number of years. 3.5 years later, suddenly I have terrible pains. I go in to see a different doctor, and that doctor says, yeah, you've got prostate cancer. You had it. In order for it to have reached this level, you've had to have had it for a number of years. You're saying, as I understand your argument, that I cannot sue the first doctor for medical malpractice. Is that correct?
Not unless from 5 years from the date of the visit where you claim he negligently diagnosed you. That is true.
Well, I've got 3 years from the date of injury. You're claiming that the date of injury is the last day of misdiagnosis, correct?
I am adding in sub B also.
Well, I don't want to go into sub B yet.
Okay.
As I understand your argument, you're saying that the date of injury is the date of the last misdiagnosis.
If it's within, if you discover
it. I think that's a perfectly reasonable question to be answered yes or no. What's the problem?
It's yes to that part, but there's okay. A second part.
Okay, then now you could give me the second part. Okay.
The second part is that if you indeed discover that you have prostate cancer, mm-hmm. at 3.5 years, you still have one additional year to bring your claim for medical malpractice, which will bring in the first doctor. You still have one more year because it's 1 year after the date of discovery. You have no idea you have prostate cancer. You think you're a normal, healthy human being.
Mm-hmm.
And that's how sub B plays in there. And that's what the legislature did when they created the discovery rule July 1st of 1980. They created that rule just for your situation that you have hypothesized so that it would not unfairly cut off somebody's rights. They would have another year to find an attorney and to bring their action. In this case, with the death of Ms. Paul on May 23, 1997, 1995, there's evidence that Mr. Colby was retained and, in fact, had requested medical records on Ms. Paul in 1996. There's evidence that there was a conversation between Mr. Colby and Dr. Metelsky as to when the legal action was going to be brought, and he said it would be 1997, and that's in the record. So why wasn't this action brought? I think that was the question that Justice Wilcox asked earlier. It wasn't until March of 1998 that this action is brought, and there's no new information that these people gained in that period of time that's in the record. There is no reason why this action could not have been brought before December 20 of 1997.
One more question.
Sure.
I think the date of the last diagnosis here was, November 20th of 1994?
December 20, 1994 is Dr. Optigraph.
December 20th of 1994, all right. So on December 21st, one day later, Jennifer comes into your office, and you're a plaintiff's lawyer now. What cause of action does she have?
She has a cause of action if the plaintiff sends her to, plaintiff's attorney, if I send her to a neurologist because she
hasn't been to a neurologist. She comes into your office and says, I just think he's wrong, so I want to sue him.
Okay.
I have headaches.
I have headaches.
That's your cause of action that you...
All right. I would interview her. Have your headaches increased in the last day? Have you had an additional event? And if she says no, she has no cause of action. If she comes to me 3 months later and she says, I continue to have headaches, They're increasing in frequency. They're increasing. Nobody did anything. They didn't send any.
The point here, excuse me for interrupting, but I want to bring you back. The point here is that you're claiming that the last day of diagnosis is when the statute begins to toll. And yet you admit that a day after that, she has no cause of action.
The statute of limitations begins to run the date of the negligent diagnosis. Mm-hmm. Yes, the date of an omission. It begins to run then. However, the legislature has seen fit, because of the situation that you presented before, to extend the statute an additional year in the event that the person does not know the injury, the person does not know the misdiagnosis. And that's what that is for. The legislative history is pretty clear on this point. And it doesn't separate, the legislative history does not separate out claims for injury versus claims for death. I think, yes.
I'm focusing on what is meant by the legislature in its use of date of injury. And you have advanced, as did the Court of Appeals, that date of injury is the date of the misdiagnosis.
Yeah. Yes.
Same thing. Date of injury equals misdiagnosis. I approach this from a very simple point of view. And that is torts 101. What do you have? You have duty. You have breach. You have cause. And you have injury. Okay. So duty here, I suppose, is duty to use reasonable care. Generally, it's more elaborate than that. Essentially, duty to use reasonable care. What's the breach here?
I think the plaintiff is claiming in paragraph 20 of their complaint of a failure to work her up, to refer her, failure to perform certain medical procedures, failure to warn her or her parents, failing to follow up. Those are all of the breaches that they're claiming.
I assume that the breach is a misdiagnosis. You have a duty to use ordinary or reasonable care, and that you breach that duty when you misdiagnose. Then the duty breach of duty is the misdiagnosis. You don't use reasonable care in doing that. Then you have cause, and that's self-explanatory. And then the fourth element of a tort is injury. And what's the injury in this case?
What happened to Jennifer Paul is that her headaches continued without medical intervention, without someone doing a CAT scan and without doing an MRI to determine that there was an arteriovenous malformation.
It seems to me that an argument can be made that the injury was the rupture, which resulted in her death. I mean, that was her injury. She's not, I don't think that the cause of action is would be, if she were still alive, for malpractice, for headaches, but rather for some kind of rupture or bleeding. So the way that I look at this is you have, just elementary, you have the duty, you have the breach, which is the misdiagnosis, the cause, and then the injury. And the misdiagnosis seems to me to be the breach and not the injury, but you're saying misdiagnosis is the injury.
It's the injury as it's used in the statute. And one clarification that I hope would be of assistance. Dr. Skemp or Dr. Updegraff or any medical provider at Franciscan Skimp did not cause that arterial venous malformation. The arterial venous malformation, the problem that Jennifer Paul had in her brain, was not a result of anything that Dr. Skimp did. In other words, he didn't operate on her
This is summary judgment. So, I mean, I'm talking about setting forth cause of action and negligence.
Sure.
That's what you need, whether or not this is summary judgment. So I don't know if anyone can prove anything if they got through summary judgment.
So I see this rather than the misdiagnosis causing the arteriovenous malformation, which then caused her death, is the alleged misdiagnosis, which the plaintiff has put in their complaint, and outlining the various failures, that caused time to pass, the headaches to persist, and eventually to have this arteriovenous malformation.
But you're saying that this diagnosis, the breach, is the injury. Aren't you saying that?
I'm saying that's how it is used
in the statute. That makes little sense to me, because breach is the misdiagnosis here. This injury is something else. And then you said, okay, injury is the headaches. So, is injury the headaches, or is injury the misdiagnosis? You seem to be arguing both now.
Well, I hope not. I hope that that the injury, I tried to get across, in my opinion, the statute is clear that the injury is the misdiagnosis. And what results from that is continued headaches.
But a misdiagnosis does not necessarily always result in injury.
No, that's true. That's why there may not, in some cases, be a cause of action. The court in the Koshnick case, this court in the Koshnick case, going back to that.
Well, follow this up. There can't be a cause of action unless there's an injury, right? So misdiagnosis, how can the legislature say misdiagnosis is an injury? When you can have a misdiagnosis without an injury. I mean, I'm looking for what the legislature meant by the use of that term. That's what I'm focusing on.
If a doctor fails to properly diagnose something that later we learn is a problem, there's a cause of action. If a doctor fails to diagnose something that never becomes a problem, there is no cause of action. So can there be a misdiagnosis that doesn't cause a problem? Yes. But in this case,
diagnosis that's not an injury.
That's right.
Could I ask?
No,
I'm sorry.
The misdiagnosis is always an injury. What you don't have is damages.
No, that's not.
Okay. Sorry.
If the court were to determine that the injury was the death and not the misdiagnosis, what would be the policy implications, the adverse policy implications from the statute?
Well, I believe that the court would be inserting, if the court is going to then change the statute of limitations to allow the death to be the injury and 3 years then begins to run as of the date of death, the legislature then has interjected what they felt is a fair result and their legislative purpose in vain. I think this court has always recognized that the legislature is the body that has to look at the broad policy implications. In this case, there was a medical malpractice crisis for which the statutory cap on damages was enacted to directly respond to that. Healthcare costs are rising at an alarming rate. Medical malpractice premiums are rising at an alarming rate.
Despite 893.55,
but they could be worse if that had not been enacted. There was a time, Justice Abramson, when doctors could not get medical malpractice insurance. And my father was involved in trying to find a way to continue to have doctors practice in certain areas when they couldn't get insurance. The legislative response to these policy reasons has been direct, and it has essentially said, yes, we're going to cut off plaintiffs' rights. We're going to try to make make it fair, though, because we're going to have this discovery statute, which we add on to the general 3-year statute of limitations. But after that, the plaintiffs cannot bring a cause of action. And I think that the same policy reasons that existed when the court was faced with the earlier decisions exist today. I see that my time is
Counsel,
up.
Let me just see if I can't summarize your answer to Justice Prosser. And it is that I think the policy would be that when you have a misdiagnosis and you have a long latent period for that misdiagnosis to show itself in a visible, tangible way, the plaintiff will not have a cause of action because it will be cut off by the 5-year term under B.
Yes.
Is that fair?
That is fair.
Thank you. Good.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, Ms. Newcomb. Mr. Colby.
It pleases the court. I have just a couple of concluding comments. And from the questions that Ms. Newcomb was fielded by the court, I think that I have some additional insight, one of which is, Justice Crooks, you indicated that you are familiar with the CAT scan that had been obtained of Jenny on 12-20-94 when she was seen by Dr. Updegraff. To give the court some sense of where we're going with the headaches existed before, headaches existed after. The complaint does not claim injury as a result of headache. The only claim that's made under the survival claim in this case is the conscious pain and suffering that Jenny experienced from the time her brain blew in her kitchen on May 22nd at about 6 a.m. to the time that she was unconscious in Dr. Metelsky's office before she was rushed to the hospital for emergency surgery. There is no claim of some conscious pain and suffering, and the point is well taken. If what was her damage? I mean, somebody walked in and said, I have a headache on 12-20-94, on 12-21-94, but on 12-20-94, when Jenny saw Dr. Updegraff, she got the same runaround. This is a headache that's sinus-related, I think. We're going to take an X-ray of you today, and we're going to give you Seldane for your sinus, and go home, and if you're not better, come back. Well, they took an X-ray, and the X-ray showed, as the court's well aware, that there wasn't anything in the sinus passage. There wasn't anything. This went undiscovered, and to somehow try to convert this case into a discovery rule case is truly a travesty, in that this young gal had to go to walk-in. She had to go through a family practitioner to wind up with the appropriate referral covered by her HMO to see a neurologist, and she never got there.
So as regards the statute of limitations in this case, as I understand your argument, the statute focuses on the injury, the date of injury, and
that's
the injury that's being litigated here is the rupture.
The rupture.
Which could have been prevented, allegedly, by a proper diagnosis.
That's
and
true.
Attendant treatment.
And the rationale to be applied is the same rationale that this court applied in the SOFA case for the pleural thickening. It's exactly the same rationale. And one of the comments made by the court is, referring to plaintiffs, to protect themselves, they will be forced to initiate litigation based upon the possibility that they will develop some serious asbestosis-related condition in the future. And more importantly, This court, in the Robbins case, back in 1983, said, in any event, the problems caused by the lapse of time must be balanced against the policy in favor of allowing diligent claimants to bring meritorious claims. It is manifestly unjust for the statute of limitations to begin to run before a claimant could reasonably become aware of the injury.
But, counsel, how do you answer Ms. Newcomb's response? Because that's what I was pushing her on, and I think she gave me a good answer. That the date of discovery, the legislature, in its wisdom and largesse, added another year. Once you've discovered this injury, you still have 1 year to bring it. And that was the balancing that the legislature, which I well remember, was faced with when faced with this malpractice crisis back in the mid-70s. So you had, or your client had, 1 year from the date of her injury, which was the rupture, to bring an action, and she didn't.
She had 1 year from the date of the rupture to discover that the rupture was related to negligence.
No.
And in this case, that's exactly the argument, Justice Babich, that I was making to begin with. This is not a discovery rule case. And what the defendants want to do, what the respondents want to do in this case, the issue is, when did the injury occur? And she had 3 years from the date of that injury to bring her action. Date of injury is the issue before this court, not discovery. And what the defendants want to do is say, in this case, because we know when the date of death occurred, and because Jenny had a lawyer within a year, we can now use that 1 year to shorten the applicable statute of limitations, and that's not appropriate. The statute says the latter of the two, 3 years or 1 year from the date of discovery. And so I urge the court to find in favor of the plaintiffs. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Covey. Thank you, Ms. Newcomb. We're going to take a short break so that the students who are coming in with our courtroom class can be seated, and those who wish to leave may leave. We'll be back in about 2 or 3 minutes. Would Mr. Covey and Ms. Newcomb approach the bench, please?